This is an ABC podcast.
My guest on Conversations is rock climber Tommy Caldwell. Though to call Tommy a rock climber doesn't quite do him justice. In 2015, Tommy and his friend Kevin Jorgensen scaled the Dawn Wall, a 3,000-foot rock face in Yosemite National Park in California. Climbing it was a feat that pretty much everyone, apart from Tommy, thought was impossible. Tommy's ascent of the Dawn Wall wasn't only the result of incredible physical tenacity. It was also built on other challenges that he'd faced, including a kidnapping, a serious accident, and a heartbreak. I spoke with Tommy Caldwell last year. Hi, Tommy.
Hi.
You spent, as I say, 19 days scaling the Dawn Wall. Where did you sleep while you're making that climb?
Yeah, so when you're big wall climbing, generally on very, very sheer walls, you bring a device called a portaledge up with you. It's like a hanging cot and it's your little nest.
When you woke up in that portaledge, Tommy, and opened the zip, what did you look out into and across?
Yeah, so El Capitan sits in the middle of Yosemite National Park, which is in the Sierra Nevada mountains, pristine pine trees, Half Dome, which is one of the most strikingly shaped mountains in the world, is a valley. There's a nice river running below you, way below you. And if you look down, the cars look like little matchbox cars.
How old were you when you started climbing?
I was really young. My dad was a mountain guide, so it was what we did as a family. I did my first roped climbs when I was around 3 years old.
Do you remember that?
Not really. I mean, I have these like vague recollections, but I do remember climbing from a really young age.
So how much of this adventuring was down to your dad? Was he the guy behind this for you as a family?
Yeah, my dad was absolutely the guy behind it. He was a bodybuilder, so he was like big and super adventurous. He was also a school teacher. Yeah.
And did you have a similar temperament? Were you a daredevil from
word go? I was like the shyest, most quiet. I was one of those kids that my dad probably sucked all the air out of the room, kind of in a way. So I was reacting to that by being really shy as a kid.
Well, how did you feel about these adventures that he'd take you on then?
Socially, I was quite odd, but the adventuring part of it, I connected with right from the beginning.
Did it give you a confidence? Do you think being physically able to do that stuff as a kid, if you felt a bit shy in school or in other settings?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely gave me a confidence, especially since I was mentally pretty delayed. Like I was a special ed student. I was born hugely premature. I had a lot of problems physically when I was young. So the adventuring side became the thing that I connected with the most, probably because it was the thing that I was the best at. And it was unique. You know, I didn't have other friends doing that stuff. So it made them admire me in a world where I would have been completely blind to everybody else otherwise.
How then did you start making a name for yourself as a climber?
So when I was a young teenager, climbing competitions started to become a thing. Like they started to develop these climbing competitions on artificial walls. And previous to that, I didn't have any way to compare myself with other people. And there weren't other kid competitors at the time, but I did enter this adult comp as a 13-year-old and won it. And it was a huge surprise. So that was the first time in my life where I was like, wow, I should make a go at this. I'm actually quite good at it.
So before that, it was more of a hobby. Was it a sense that you could make a life out of climbing? Was that an option?
There was not a sense of that when I was young. When I turned 13, I was like, I could maybe make a life out of climbing. But you have to remember that climbing had this dirt bag culture. Everybody admired giving up on everything in life and dedicating yourself completely to climbing. Like that was the climbing culture. That was sort of the ultimate, to like live in a cave, steal food out of the grocery store, whatever, to live. And so making a living as a professional climber meant dumpster diving. You know, it was like very impoverished lifestyle.
Did the dropout aspect of the culture ever appeal to you? Could you see yourself as a dumpster diving climber?
Yeah, that's how I identified for a long time. I did dumpster dive. I loved the fact that I could live off of $50 a month. You know, I'd work for a few months, or maybe I'd enter a climbing competition and win a few $100, and that would last me months. And honestly, to this day, that serves me really well because I'm not concerned with money. Like life, when it was that simple, was quite lovely. And so I always know that that kind of life is an option.
So when you were a teenager, Tommy, and still at high school, how much time were you spending climbing?
I decided not to go to college because I wanted to focus. Well, what I said is I was going to take a year off of school after high school and see how climbing went, and it went quite well. So I never went to college. So when I was in high school, it started to overtake my life in a lot of ways. I would train after school every day until quite late at night, which means I would sleep through the first period class the next day.
Were you training at? Actually climbing or in a gym, or what was training like?
During the week, I would climb sometimes in a climbing gym that was an hour from my house. I also built an artificial training wall in my parents' garage. And then on the weekends, we would go to local climbing areas because we lived in the Colorado Rockies, which has got climbing everywhere.
And is being a good climber, were you working out at that age? Is it mainly about strength?
I think it's partially about strength. It's a little bit about strength and strength to weight ratio. Like, good climbers are kind of small. But there's a huge mental element. And in my mind, it's a combination of like chess, because there's all this strategy and movement and things that you analyze. Then there's the strength building. And then there's the sort of risk management and fear side of it that all have to come together in this way that demands all of you. And it tends to create this flow state that is really addicting.
Do you remember being scared as a kid when you were climbing or a teenager? Was fear something you had to manage?
Yeah, there was times when I would be a bit scared. Like, we would go high into the mountains during big thunderstorms. You know, we'd get in ourselves in big storms. I remember having lightning strike quite close to me, you know, when I was 7 years old and hiking through these mountains. I remember going up on my first big walls and having big chunks of ice fall down the wall. And so managing fear and risk was something that, it was almost a good thing. It was something that you learned how to harness. And I love that to this day.
And I guess those experiences, would you label them at the time, were they exciting or scary, or did those terms kind of blur a bit for you?
I mean, I tend to think almost everything is exciting as opposed to scary. A lot of times things that other people think are absolutely terrifying, I'm just like, oh, that was good fun.
Tell me, what took you to Kyrgyzstan as a young climber?
I had gotten a couple of years prior to that really into climbing in Yosemite National Park. It's kind of the mecca for big wall climbing, which is the kind that I sort of settled into after being a competition climber as a teenager. And Kyrgyzstan was much like Yosemite with these big granite walls, but in a kind of more remote, exotic location. And so my girlfriend at the time was a North Face sponsored athlete and decided to send a trip to Kyrgyzstan to fund the trip so that we could come back with photos and video footage that they could use in advertising. I kind of weaseled my way onto the trip as a rigger for the photography.
And was the terrain beautiful when you arrived?
Oh yeah, absolutely breathtaking. I mean, these big high mountains with these glaciers and these really crazy looking yak walking all over the place. And it was kind of everything we'd hoped for.
Were you aware at all about what was going on politically in the country when you were there?
So the previous year, there had been some Japanese geologists in an adjacent valley that had come across some sort of rebel activity. And we found that information on the U.S. State Department website, but it was very vague and they had just a minor warning. So we started looking around at other places in the world and the levels of warnings that they had. And that year, Sydney actually had the Olympics. And so they had a terrorist warning that was exactly the same level of threat. And we're like, well, people are still going to the Olympics. We might as well go to this valley.
So what happened to you? How did you get caught up in what was going on?
So we were camped up on our first climb, about 1,000 feet up this big wall. And we had had a pretty wonderful week climbing and hanging out. It felt very peaceful and really nice. But this one morning we woke up to gunshots, and turns out this rebel group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan was moving through the valley. They had the high mountain passes had melted out, so they were able to kind of sneak from one country to the next over these borders. And so they heard that we were up this valley, so they kind of made a U-turn and came up and found us up on this wall.
And did you have any idea after you heard those gunshots what was happening or who
no,
it could be?
Yeah, first we thought it was hunters. We had no idea. First I thought it was rockfall or something, but once it kept happening and bullets started to actually kind of ricochet off the wall around us, we knew we were getting shot at. We had a long telephoto lens that we were able to look at the ground and see that there were these men down there in army fatigues, and they were shooting up at us and motioning for us to come down.
And how did they communicate what they wanted? Did they speak English?
No, but it was obvious that we needed to come down. Like, you can't really run away. So we sent our oldest member of our expedition, John Dickey, down first. He had a two-way radio, and he went down there to talk to them. We had to tie all of our ropes together, and it took him about an hour to get to the ground.
So she had to climb down the mountain to get...
Yeah, descend ropes. We had just enough rope to get all the way to the ground. And so he descended down those ropes, and then he radioed back up to us that we had to come down.
And what did you think was going to happen to you?
I mean, we had no idea. At first, we were trying to be optimistic. We thought maybe they would just take us back to our base camp. Because although they were shooting at us when we first saw them face to face, they looked quite scary. I mean, they were heavily armed. They had a mixture of kind of army fatigues and then equipment they had stolen from another climbing team. And so our first thought was maybe they just want to steal some of our stuff and then they'll let us go. But the situation escalated pretty quickly.
And what did they want from you?
I mean, I think that they were going to hold us for ransom. They just saw dollar signs, most likely. We're, you know, a relatively wealthy group of Western climbers on a corporate expedition to the area. And war did end up breaking out around us. So in a way, we were kind of bullet shields for them.
Did people in the States know that you'd been taken hostage?
For the most part, people didn't know. There was a tour company that had brought us into the valley, and they didn't inform the embassy right off the bat. I think they were a little bit worried about them being liable. My girlfriend's father actually was the only person I knew of that dug into the news enough to find out that there was this minor uprising, and he did a little of investigative work of his own and found out that we might have gotten wrapped up in it before anybody else knew. But he didn't even tell his wife because she didn't want to worry him until he found out for sure what had gone down.
And once this group had you, how many men
so
were
there
with
four,
you?
So there was four men that captured us originally that took us hostage. And then, like I said, a war broke out pretty quickly. And we were involved in heavy gun battle. We saw a Kyrgyz soldier that had also been taken hostage, shot point blank right in front of us, essentially. And we had to hide behind a boulder, like lying on his body for like 6 hours as this crazy battle raged around us. And as it got dark that first night, we were able to flee the scene of the battle still as hostages. And then two of those four men just disappeared that night. We don't know what happened to them. And so for most of our captivity, there were just two captors and then the four of us climbers.
And were you hiding or were they moving you around? What was happening day by day?
Yeah, so we would, at night, we would sneak from one hiding place to the next. And then during the day, we would bed down. We would kind of bury ourselves in holes in the ground, cover ourselves with brush. We would hide in places that seemed unsurvivable. And so it was, and we didn't have any food. We had to abandon, when that battle broke out, we had to abandon all of our food and warmer clothing. So did our captors. They were just as bad off as we were. I had managed to grab like six power bars, like energy bars. And so that's the only food that we had for those 6 days. And we split that between the six of us, the four climbers and the two captors. We would split one power bar a day.
And so how did the four of you think this might end?
I mean, we started to strategize pretty quickly. The lead member of our expedition came up with a plan pretty quickly to try and make these captors believe that we were on their side. So on night one, we were fleeing this battle and we had to cross this raging river and we couldn't figure out how to get across it. And our captors were kind of trying to push a log, and it was this very steep, steep hillside with this raging river. And our captors were trying to push this log across, but they couldn't quite manage it because it was kind of too big and covered in branches. And so one of the members of our expedition, Jason Singer, he grabbed this log in this very heroic moment, middle of night, like plowed into this waist deep river and dragged the log across. And that enabled us all to kind of hop across this log that he had dragged across. And after that, our captors, you know, looked at, and I remember right after that moment, they kind of held their guns in there and they're like, soldad, like soldier, like you're a hero. And they really believed that we were completely with them. Like we were all fleeing the Kyrgyz military together. And so that allowed us to get the upper hand kind of mentally. So we strategized escape for the next several days. And
so the idea was that they'd trust you a little and then you could try and escape.
Yeah.
So how did you decide to go about trying to get away?
I mean, so it was a pretty long, arduous discussion. I remember, so that same guy, Jason, he was very adamant that we needed to find a way to overtake our captors. When we were hiding every day, he would be analyzing their guns, and he would be talking in these very graphic details about how we were going to, you know, grab rocks and bash in their heads and, you know, gouge out their eyes and things like that. It'd been pretty violent. And I didn't like the idea of killing somebody. You know, I was really young at the time. And
how old were you?
I turned 21 the day we got captured. So I was quite young, and I was just kind of like a gentle soul, you know, and he was a bit more like macho kind of guy. And we had watched them murder Kyrgyz soldiers point blank. And I was like, we should just wait this out. I think we can physically stand, you know, outlast these guys, because we're climbers. And they had actually traveled over a big mountain pass to get to us. So they were physically a bit more depleted than we were. They had big guns. We were more comfortable in the terrain. And so we talked about this stuff a bunch. But the situation got more and more dire. Like I said, we all ended up losing 20 pounds. We were on the verge of hypothermia the whole time. And so after 6 days, as our bodies sort of wasted away, we got to a point where a storm seemed like it was brewing. And we were climbing this big, steep mountainside. The lead captor, this guy named Abdul, had decided to try and go back to our base camp to get some food that we had left there. And he was going to circle around and meet us on top of this mountain that he had instructed us to climb up with just one remaining captor. Sharapov was his name. So it was four climbers, one remaining captor. We were on really steep terrain, like the type of terrain that seems like if you start falling, you won't stop. And it was nighttime. And so it was dead obvious that this was a chance to escape. So, it was one of these situations where I've been so adamant that we should not try and escape, but I thought we were going to die. Like if we got in a storm, I thought we were going to succumb to hypothermia. Jason and then the other male member of our expedition, John, they kind of hatched a plan that the two other climbers, Beth and I, would stay up ahead and we would kind of find the route up the mountain. And we were guiding our one captor at that point. We're actually pointing out hand and footholds. He was quite scared. And they were going to find a way to push him off a cliff. But it's just hard to do. You know, when it comes down to it, the decision to do that is really hard. And so as we were about to crest the top of this mountain, you know, I decided that it had to be done. So I was the one that ended up pushing this guy off a cliff in the end.
Was that a conscious decision? Like there was a moment when you thought, okay, I'm going to push him off, or you found yourself sort of acting before you were thinking?
No, it was a very conscious decision. We were thinking about it the whole time. I actually went up to my girlfriend because we were almost split in two groups. Like the Jason and John thought that killing this man was really the way out. Beth and myself thought the other. We didn't think it was the way, but it became more and more obvious that probably that was our way out as we were climbing this mountainside. So I went up to Beth right before we got to the top of the mountain. I was like, I think I'm going to have to do this. Are you okay with this? And she didn't say anything. So that was me kind of had her blessing. She was at least mixed about it. And so, yeah, it was very, very conscious.
Do you remember those moments just before you pushed him, Tommy?
Yeah. I mean, you can't forget that kind of stuff. Yeah. I mean, I remember he saw the end of the climb and he wanted to be out of the exposure. And so he passed us actually on this ledge and started to kind of scramble ahead. And then I decided that it was time. So I basically scrambled across this ledge behind him and grabbed him and pulled him off under moonlight. We watched him fall about 20 feet, hit this ledge and then bounce off of it. And then he fell into the blackness.
What did you do next?
We finished the climb. We got to the top of the mountain. I sat down on the ground and grabbed my knees and just kind of broke down. You know, it was a very intense situation. We didn't know if Abdul was going to be up at the top of the mountain. We thought we were going to meet him up there, and we just killed the other member of the Rebel Alliance. And so it was a tense situation, but we didn't see him up there. So I was sitting there kind of breaking down, and Beth and Jason and John came up and kind of tried to console me. But we're pretty quickly like, we got to get out of here. So we kind of traversed around the side of the mountain, then went down a much less steep side and started to make our way towards a military outpost that we knew of that was down valley a ways.
Who were on the side that you wanted to be connected with?
Kyrgyz military outpost, yeah.
So once you reached them, you'd got to safety.
Right.
You were so young, you just turned 21. How on earth did you make sense of this thing that you'd done?
I mean, it was hard to make sense of, absolutely. I mean, there were so many dynamics involved. There was sort of this group dynamic with the four of us. There was the fact that I had killed somebody. I think in a way, I felt very mixed. Like, I felt pretty devastated about the fact that I had made this decision to kill another person. And I didn't see him as a bad person. He was a victim of circumstance. He was probably 18 years old. I could kind of see myself in him a little bit. It was just a bad situation that I had to do this for us to get out of there. But then in a way I was like a little bit empowered, because you always wonder if you are confronted with something that serious, how you will react, how will you be able to save your life and save the life of your friends? And I had been able to do that. So in some ways that might've helped me heal better than some of the other people of the expedition. I mean, we were all messed up in many ways. My girlfriend went to therapy for, you know, number of years, and there's ripple effects of the trauma of that experience that have affected us forever. John, the leader of the expedition, he got into heavy like criminal activity and basically had to flee the country. I had a really solid family life in this climbing background, so I feel like I had a bit more to rely on, which helped.
What did your dad say about that? Do you remember about that whole experience? I mean, how did he respond?
Yeah, both my parents were overwhelmed. I mean, they didn't know how to deal with something like that. They tried to comfort me as best they could. They were there for me every moment. My dad's a pretty macho guy, like I said, and he loved the fact that I was making it as a professional climber. I was kind of living out his biggest dream, and this was potentially distracting from that. So I stopped climbing for a bit of time, and I was considering life, and he thought that climbing was this great healing thing, because it always had been for me. And so his reaction was to try and get me out climbing. I remember at one point he said something like, "You have to get back up on that horse," you know, and which made my girlfriend Beth at the time like furious. He's like, how? I mean, it was just complicated, you know. It was crazy, crazy time in life.
Tommy, when did you find out what really happened to the man you believed you'd killed on that mountain?
So I think it was about 3 months after we returned. There was a lot of media surrounding this event, and a reporter, actually somebody that I knew a little bit, and she was she did copy editing for one of my sponsors. She pitched this story without consulting us to Playboy magazine, and Playboy magazine was like, sure, yeah, write this story. And then she came to us, and we had already signed an exclusive agreement to give the story to Outside magazine at the time. And so we told her that we couldn't. And so that turned her against us in this weird way. But she was a very adamant researcher. And so she was actually the one that found out that he was alive and that he was in prison. Her and her husband became this kind of journal team that started researching the story. And when they called us and told us, we didn't believe them. I mean, it seemed absolutely unbelievable. We saw him fall into blackness around such a steep hillside. We were like, why are they messing with us in this way? Yeah, but it turns out it was true.
What did that do to your understanding of that night and who you were?
You know, I think I was relieved that I hadn't ended up killing somebody. That was a big part of it. I think if you ask my dad, he said that I came back to life after a few months of being almost silent. I don't remember it so much that way, though. I remember being happy about that. But also what really pained me was the fact that I had made that decision. So I think it was, you know, it was healing to a point.
The next obstacle you faced, Tommy, was when you and Beth were renovating a house together. What happened?
Yeah, we were back from Kyrgyzstan. We had decided to buy a little rundown cabin in Estes Park, Colorado, and we're renovating it. And I had borrowed my parents' table saw. I was building a stand for a washing machine and chopped off my index finger. And it was at an interesting time because I had come back from Kyrgyzstan and I had gotten through, I basically felt like I had gotten through the worst of the emotional trauma, and I was focused very much on climbing. Climbing did, in fact, become my way to heal, as it always had been, and my way to strengthen myself. And so I had gotten very, very dedicated towards climbing, as had my girlfriend. And so we were on that path, and then I chopped off my index finger. And
So chopped it clean off.
Yeah, chopped it clean off.
And yep. Now, no one wants to lose a finger, but why is that such a big deal for a climber?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I meet plenty of disabled climbers these days, and a finger seems like such a minor thing, honestly. But for me, it felt serious because I was in the top couple percentages of like best climbers in the world, and there was really only room for like two or three professional climbers financially at that time, and so we were pretty sure that was going to make the difference between being able to make a life of this or having to figure out another way to live.
And for people who don't climb, it's because when you're actually clinging onto that rock, every finger, every digit is essential in keeping you there. Is that what's so crucial about the sort of logistics, right, physical aspect of the climbing?
Yeah, and steep technical rock climbing, everything is about your fingers. You're clinging onto the side of the rock with your 10 fingers. And so even to this day, I spend most of my training time just trying to strengthen my fingers.
Did people advise you to give up climbing after that accident?
Yeah, I mean, I remember my doctor, who was a bit of a climber himself since we lived in Colorado and there's a lot of climbers there, came to me. I spent 2 weeks in the hospital. They tried to do everything they could to reattach the finger. It didn't work. It ended up dying. And the doctor came into the room and told me that I should think about what else I want to do in life because I wasn't going to be able to climb anymore. He didn't think I was going to be able to professionally climb anymore. And I don't know if that was strategic or what, but it was like the perfect thing to say because it gave me fuel to kind of prove him wrong.
Did you have to relearn how to climb, or how much of your technique did you have to change?
I had to change my technique a little bit. I got some weird imbalance issues in my hand that I had to sort out how to hold my hand in specific ways. But I think the fact that it reset my expectations, like I didn't have to prove anything at that point to anybody. If any climbing that I did was just kind of like, it felt like a blessing at that time. And the fact that I was able to climb quite well pretty early on was hugely empowering. And it kind of like set me into this process of progression that made me become a way, way better climber than I was before Kyrgyzstan, before losing my finger. I mean, I think climbing is incredible adversity training. From a really young age, we were going out in the mountains and we were purposely exposing ourselves to difficult things because we knew it would bring out the best in us. So when hardship unintentionally happened through Kyrgyzstan and my finger, I kind of just approached it the same way. I was like, wow, this is the chance for me to be brought to life and really learn about who I am and what I'm capable of.
And broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Konorski.
Tommy, you and Beth had been through so much. You'd been kidnapped. She'd been with you as you survived this accident, which had threatened your whole climbing career. You were still so young. How did all that play out for you as a couple?
I think it bonded us in a very tight, possibly unnaturally tight way. We became attached at the hip, incredibly codependent. I would go on climbing trips without her and she would kind of start to panic. I think she was afraid of life in general after having gone through something like that. And we kind of became each other's rock in a way that felt kind of magical, weirdly, for a long time. We became, a lot of people called us the first couple of climbing because we would go out and we would climb these big wall routes together and we were so dedicated towards that pursuit and we were so dedicated and loyal to each other that a lot of people admired that. 3 or 4 years after Kyrgyzstan, we got married and then, yeah, we were together for about 4 years after that.
And what ended things?
I mean, it wasn't my decision, I guess, in the end. But I think the way that that Beth sees it, and I suppose I see it this way too, is that codependence eventually turned itself to resentment in a way. Like, she couldn't feel safe without me. And so in a way, I needed to go away for her to regain her self-confidence. She ended up finding another man, and very quickly, yeah, we split up.
I wonder if that was almost, I don't know, in some ways a harder kind of loss, because the other things you'd had her to face them with, you had that person right next to you to face being kidnapped or face losing a finger and maybe your climbing career. Was it almost scarier to lose the person you were making this future together with?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was. And I think this goes to my personality a little bit. Like, I'm emotionally relatively meek, I guess, in a lot of ways. I don't, physically strong, but emotionally kind of meek. All the other hardships, I felt like I could be brought to life with that. I didn't feel like that. I didn't know what to do. I felt quite devastated.
Did you keep climbing even in the sort of dark days post your breakup?
Yeah, I think I got pretty reclusive. I moved back to Colorado into the house that we had built together, but it was a struggle for a while.
Did your attitude to climbing change, given it was something that you'd done so closely together for so long?
I mean, I had to figure out ways to climb without having a reliable partner like I had in her. But essentially, I treated climbing like I had from the beginning. It became sort of my rock. It became the thing that I relied on. It became the thing that brought positivity and excitement into my life. And it also became a distraction. That was maybe one of the things I most successfully used it for. Like, I could go out in the mountains and just grind it out, head down towards some big climbing objective, and that distracted me from the heartache.
I guess hanging on to a centimeter is going to focus your mind in a way that few other things
do. Yeah, like I said before, it creates incredible flow. And so I think I sought that experience out even more vigorously after breaking up with Beth.
When did the Dawn Wall come into your mind as something that you wanted to attempt?
That was the time. That was when it came into my mind. I think I was searching for something that I could totally lose myself in, because I wanted to lose myself. I had this idea that part of the Dawn Wall, this very impossible looking route on El Cap, was possible. I was the one person that probably thought that it might be possible. So I think the chance to be an explorer, to take my sport, my passion, to a place that nobody had, seemed like an exciting opportunity to me.
And why, out of all the rocks in all the world, why this one in particular? What is it about the Dawn Wall that made it so exciting?
El Capitan is center stage for big wall climbing. It's 1,000 meters tall. It's the most pristine. It has the best rock, and it's all the techniques behind big wall climbing were developed there. It's where the history of big wall climbing has played out. And it's also the rock that I had spent the last almost 15 years of my life primarily focused on climbing on that wall.
And the Dawn Wall is a section of El Capitan.
Right.
And
yeah.
Why hadn't it been climbed before?
So I had done all the easier free climbs on the wall. I think I had free climbed it 11 times via crack systems and parts of the wall that were easier to climb. The Dawn Wall represented the next step because it just looked blank. It looked like there wasn't anything to hold on to. But since I had spent so many years climbing up there, I knew that sometimes these little edges form on these pieces of rock that look totally blank from afar. And if you train properly and if you work long enough and hard enough, you can find that path of resistance through this maze. I needed an impossible challenge because I wanted something that would consume me completely.
How did people react when you started saying that you were thinking of trying to climb the Dawn Wall?
I mean, I think when I first would mention it to other climbers, they'd be like, that's silly. You know, that's not going to work. Just look at it. It's not going to work. And then I spent almost a year up there searching and found a line of holds. And I, you know, there was a path there. And
what do you mean a path? Because like when you just look at it in photos or in film, it just looks like a sheer cliff. What are you finding up close?
Right. So I took a bunch of rope to the top of the cliff and I started descending down and swinging back and forth and like running my hands over the surface of the rock, essentially, and looking with my eyes and finding these tiny, tiny little edges that were just enough to kind of like pull onto the rock. That line of what is completely impossible to climb and what is possible to climb really comes down to just like some teeny, tiny little edges, like the size of the edge of a credit card or something. And so I started to piece together these moves. Imagine, you know, sometimes you have to hold your face right up close to the wall to even see these little bits of grit that you can stand on, and trying to find sort of that maze of holds that links from the bottom of the wall all the way to the top. That's why it seems so improbable. but it does come down to an insane amount of memorization, because finding the holds that theoretically make it so you can climb it is one thing, but then rehearsing those moves and executing them perfectly, that's what took the next 7 years. We had to...
7 years.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin Jorgensen joined the climb, and then we spent 7 years, you know, trying to perfect that routine, because the difference between being successful and not successful is the matter of your hips being, you know, a centimeter out of position, and the rubber on your shoe being 1 centimeter off. You know, you have to memorize everything till you can close your eyes and execute it perfectly on the hardest section of this climb. So it became this huge puzzle. And then plus we had to learn how to live on the side of the wall for weeks at a time. Nobody had really done that, and we had been climbing at night primarily.
You say you were climbing at night. What's that like?
It took a bit of getting used to. I think at first it felt a bit eerie, but once we got used to it, it was actually quite nice. Because you got to remember, we remembered these moves so perfectly that it was almost like we could climb them with our eyes closed. And then that feeling of being up there in your headlamp, and we also had this mountain biking light that we could kind of shine across the section of wall. So it was, and the wind wasn't usually there, so it was very quiet, and you didn't feel the exposure because you couldn't see the ground. In some ways it helped because it allowed you to focus completely.
What were the stars like when you were there on the side of the rock?
The stars are, I mean, super nice. We're in the mountains. There's not a whole lot of, ambient light. So they're right there. They feel close, but it's only half sky view because you're on a vertical rock face. You look up and you see half of the sky, but you do spend a lot of time just laying in there in your portal edge, looking up and turning off your headlamp and just being in the midst of this very, very wonderful, very, very exciting place. And, you know, high up on this rock face with the, yeah, I mean, it's just a cool place to be. Like in certain seasons, these birds would fly all around us and we'd watch them kind of chasing each other around. In the springtime, if we climbed up there, a lot of times if there was snow up on the mountain, it would kind of melt and drop down in these like gumdrop sized droplets. Then you'd get this updraft because the wall's so big that it creates its own weather. And so these gum droplets would hit the wind and kind of fly around us in these swarms like fireflies. And sometimes this equilibrium would happen where these big droplets of water would like hover right in front of you and you could like pluck them out of the air. It was just really a really cool and very beautiful environment to live in for all those years.
What kind of physical training were you doing off the wall, as well as all that sort of mapping and planning? How were you building up the strength that you would need, the really specific strength that you'd need to climb that?
I would spend about 3 months a year on the route, actually learning the specific moves and figuring it all out. And then the rest of the year I would train. So a lot of that was finger strength training.
How do you strengthen your fingers?
I did a lot of training on a thing called a hangboard with a stopwatch, where I would hang on these specific size holds for certain amounts of time. Pain tolerance is a big thing on your fingertips. You're grabbing these sharp edges. So one thing that I did at one point was screw a paint stirring stick to a vertical piece of plywood and try and hang from it.
Is that possible?
Yeah. If you get your skin condition just right and you build the strength and that sort of body tension, it is possible.
How do you toughen up the skin, particularly on your fingers?
So the best way to do it is just go climbing. And that's also the most fun way to do it. Like climbing is kind of a painful sport at a high level. But if you go outside and you're distracted by the beauty and the movement and sort of the dance of it all, it distracts from that pain.
How did you find Kevin, the friend who went on this climb, this madcap planning climb with you? Was he someone you knew well beforehand?
You know, I mapped out the route. I found the route. And then at some point, I kind of gave up because I knew that it would be like a 5 or 6 year process to get this climb sorted out. And I didn't know if I wanted, you know, I didn't know how I'd feed myself essentially if I dedicated my whole life towards this like fruitless pursuit that may or may never actually come to be. So I gave up. But a friend of mine, a filmmaker that I'd worked with for a lot of years, came to me. He said, let's go up there. Let's make a movie, a short video about this climb so we can put it out there to future generations. Because we both believed that this was the future of the sport of big wall free climbing. And if I wasn't going to do it, we should at least show it to other people. And so we did that. Kevin saw that film clip and he gave me a call. And it was at a time when I was, I'd given up kind of, but I really loved the idea of being able to do it. So when Kevin called me, I was like, oh, maybe I should go up there with Kevin and give it a shot. But he was not a big wall climber at all. You know, he didn't know how to do that kind of stuff. So I thought at first that I would go up there with him. Maybe he'd just end up belaying me, kind of holding the other end of the rope. But pretty quickly, he became obsessed with the climb in the same way I had. And he was a hard worker and he, you know, had a good attitude. And yeah, our partnership started.
What else was going on in your life in these years of training to make the ascent on Dawn Wall?
I met my now wife, Becca, and we got married during this process. We had a baby during this process. And
what did she think about your plans to climb the Dawn Wall?
What did she think? I mean, she was incredibly supportive. I mean, she fell in love with me and got to know me at a time when she knew that I was obsessed by this thing. So in a way, like, the guy who is really obsessed over climbing the Dawn Wall is the person she fell in love with. But when we had a kid, I didn't know if it was responsible to go to Yosemite for months at a time. And so there was one season where I was like, this is my last season. My son's going to be born here pretty soon and I shouldn't be here. But she actually would come to me and be like, you know, what kind of message would that be giving your son if you gave up on your dream the moment he was born? She'd say like, oh, I love the idea of bringing our, you know, little baby to Yosemite for 2 months at a time and living in a van and walking around the meadows of El Cap. And, you know, she did have this history. Like, I was raised in Yosemite in a way. My father would bring me and the family to Yosemite. And so we did know that that could be a great way to raise our kids. But she wasn't a climber when I met her. So the fact that she was willing to do this was, I don't know, I felt very loved, I suppose. And she's also a strong, strong, strong woman. And so I never could have continued on this journey without full support from her.
After all those years of planning and training and strengthening, the time came in January 2015 for you to begin the ascent. Why did you choose to climb in winter?
Kevin and I started climbing on the route more in the fall months when the weather is quite a lot drier. But that aspect of the wall, it faces straight south. It's quite sunny. So it was just hot. It was just really hot up there. And when it's hot, the skin on your fingers is softer and we get cut quite a lot faster. The rubber on your shoes is softer. It would melt, kind of like melt a little bit and soften and roll off the edges. So we started to realize that the days that were cold, we would climb much better. So each year we would push back our season a little bit later until we were basically climbing in dead winter.
Does it snow there in winter?
Yeah, it does snow there. But luckily for us, California is mostly in drought now. So when I was a kid, you couldn't climb in Yosemite in the winter. But the climate has changed enough that winter is quite good for climbing now.
As you're climbing up, do you think about how high you are and the risk of falling?
Yeah, I mean, it's a constant conversation with risk. I mean, The thing about the Dawn Wall that I really loved was that it felt very adventurous. It fulfilled that need for adventure that I have. But if you thought about it incredibly logically, it wasn't all that dangerous because the wall is absolutely sheer. Like, if you fall, there's nothing to hit. The ropes are quite strong. Sometimes the gear that you clip into the wall with is quite far apart. So you are exposing yourself to really long falls, which are scary, but I never felt like we were going to die.
On the film, when you and Kevin fall, it looks like you're smashing really hard into that rock face. That must hurt.
On occasion, you do have an abrupt stop at the end of your rope, but it's the kind of thing that can like bruise you slightly. You know, you're not going to shatter because of it.
After a day climbing, as you were making this ascent from the bottom up, which part of you was sorest at the end of a day when you were back in your portal edge?
I mean, this climb was interesting in that the climbing itself was so difficult and so fingertip intensive that it was really just the skin in our fingertips. I had done a lot of other climbs on El Cap that you climbed for a whole day for like 24 hours straight to do. This climb, we would climb like 5 hours a day. And so we'd have a lot of time to just hang out and rest. So physically, it wasn't actually all that strenuous. It was just the skin on our fingertips.
Again, this is all relative, I think, Tommy.
Yeah. I mean, you had to execute it perfectly, but it didn't like beat you down the way that you might think.
How would you treat your fingertips or look after them once you'd finished the climbing that you were doing for a day?
We became very, very obsessed with how to treat our fingertips. We had a skincare kit that rivaled that of a beauty queen up there for sure. We had little, like, we would climb each pitch, we would take little razor blades and cut off the the little bits of our skin that had been pulled away. And then we would take sandpaper and kind of smooth it out so that we wouldn't have these imperfections that would then get re-caught on the holds. We also do the same thing with our shoes. We would shave them with a razor blade and sand them with sandpaper. And then at night, I would apply various forms of skin cream. I had a sponsor at the time who actually developed a product that had plant steroid in it that was supposed to increase blood flow to my fingertips to help it heal faster. So I would use that. I would set my alarm for several times throughout the night to get up and like reapply and then put tape around it to try and hold moisture in because you need moisture to heal more quickly. And we invented new gear. I mean, over six years, we got the climb down to these micro details. We tried to think of everything we could to get better at the climbing. And that was part of the fun in it. You know, that was the fascination.
Could you see people down below watching you?
By the time we went for our final attempt, it was middle of winter. And generally, there's nobody in Yosemite in the middle of winter. But when we got to a point about halfway up the climb where it seemed like success might actually happen, we had smartphones with us and we were telling the story of our climb through Instagram primarily. And a reporter from the New York Times named John Branch was following our story. It got picked for the cover and it blew up. Like it became the first day's story was so widely read that they decided to continue to put it on the cover of the newspaper for 7 days straight. And it was taking us so darn long that it gave a lot of people time to become super interested in this story. So there was nobody watching us at the start, but by the time we were a little over halfway through, there was like 7 news trucks in the valley, and it blew up in the media in this incredible way that was so strange and so unexpected.
Did that increase the pressure that you felt on yourself to finish it?
It certainly did on Kevin. I had trained so well for this final season that I was crushing it. You know, I was going up and climbing so well. And so I got through the hardest section of the climb pretty quickly. And then Kevin started failing as the news started to take off about the climb.
Tell me about that section. Is it pitch 15?
Yeah. So there's, if you take the climb and you break it into all of the pitches or the sections, pitch 15 was the hardest pitch overall, or pitch 14 and 15 were the hardest pitches overall. What was hard about it is that the holds were smaller. We spent probably half of our time practicing the route on those two pitches. So
and it kind of looks to watch it like you're just going horizontally. It almost looks like you're just climbing across the rock.
Yeah, it's a section of the wall where you have to climb sideways from one kind of crack system to the next. They're separated by about 60 meters of terrain that is very blank, almost completely blank. I remember when I first told Kevin that I thought that was the way we would climb, he thought I was batty. He couldn't believe that was the only way.
I can't believe that's the only time Kevin thought you were batty. But yeah,
okay. No, it wasn't the only time. But
you managed to do that fairly easily.
Yes.
What happened with Kevin?
So Kevin, when he started to try pitch 15, it just didn't go quite as well. And he cut his fingers, basically. He started to wear out his fingers a bit too quickly. And so the next week became this waiting game of like trying to wait long enough to let his fingers heal enough and then try the pitch again. And meanwhile, I started to climb ahead on the route because I just wanted to get to a point where I knew that success was inevitable. And then that would allow me to completely focus on helping Kevin. And yeah, so all this drama played out because there really became this question of whether I would finish the route without him. Like what was more important?
Could you physically finish without him?
Yeah, I could have definitely finished because we would belay each other, but we had these fixed ropes that we could use as kind of an elevator to get back from one pitch to the other. So after I did pitch 15 and Kevin couldn't, I started over the next days to do the next pitches. And so he would come along and he would belay me, but then we'd go back to pitch 15 and I would belay him.
How many times did he try to cross that section of the wall?
I think he just tried it 12 times over like 7 or 9 days.
Did he want to give up?
Yeah, I think the way he talks about it is he went through this emotional roller coaster and he would try and convince himself he'd be able to do it. Maybe the conditions would change slightly and he would get excited and then he would fail and he would get devastated. And kind of that emotional roller coaster was really hard to take. And he was sort of at his wit's end. And I had sort of lost hope at that point. I didn't think he was going to be able to do it either. But I had also, at the same time, made this decision that topping out without him didn't feel right either.
Like, why?
Because I think that we had spent so many years working on this climb together. And I had grown up in this history of like mountaineers where you don't leave a buddy up on the mountain, you finish together. And so it didn't feel right. I decided that I wasn't going to finish without him, which put a lot of pressure on him in one way. I tried to also be very relaxed about it. I was like, this is such an experience. The whole experience was so intense and exciting that we both had this feeling that this was something that we were never going to forget. And if it lasted another week, that was okay with me. And then if we ended up failing in the end, then we'd just come back the next year and give it another go.
What was the moment then like when he managed to cross successfully that section of the Dawn Wall?
That morning we woke up and it was overcast, and so for the first time in a while we were able to climb in the daylight hours. And there was a bit of a wind on the wall, which also cooled things off a bit. And wind is just really, really good for the friction on your fingertips. It dries everything out really well. So he built a bit of confidence through these weather conditions, essentially. And so I started to feel kind of excited because I was like, maybe this could actually happen. And he was really excited. And that was enough for him to finally get through this pitch 15 section.
Was it at that point, Tommy, that you thought this is going to be possible? We will be able to finish this climb.
Yeah, once he did that pitch, I was like, we're going to the top.
What was that moment like when you finally pulled yourself over the top of the Dawn Wall?
You know, it was pretty mixed for me. I think Kevin and I had a morning the day that we topped out, a couple hundred feet from the top. It was just Kevin and I and our head filmmaker, Brett, sitting on our portal edge, knowing that success was inevitable. And it was this glory moment. We were up high on the wall, and the way that the sun hit the wall was like we were the only thing in the sun in all of Yosemite. Everything else was like crusted and frost and ice. And I remember sitting up there and just feeling the sun and knowing that we had been on this amazing, amazing life experience, this crazy adventure together, and just being like, this is what life is all about. This is really incredible. We're jacked on coffee. It was just as good as it gets.
And who was there to meet you when you came over the top?
And then we topped out, and the media storm that had happened, there was probably about 50 very, very motivated reporters that had hired local guides and managed to make their way to the top of the wall, which involved like 8 miles of hiking through the Yosemite backcountry in the middle of winter. It was kind of carnage. Like, there was reporters making their way back into Yosemite Valley like 4 a.m. the next day, like on the verge of death. But they did make it to the top. And so when we topped out, there was news crews and there was friends and the president was trying to get a hold of us. And it was very surreal. There's celebration on one hand, but it was a bit sad for me on another hand, because I'd like had this love affair with this climb that ended that day. And I was sick. I'd been yelling so loudly to Kevin, like encouraging him for all those days. And I was dehydrated and I lost my voice completely. And suddenly I was like on news stations around the world. I couldn't even talk. Such a weird day.
What does it mean for your climbing now, having achieved that thing that you'd worked towards for so long?
I mean, that's probably the main difficulty. Like, I miss climbing right now because I spend so much time traveling, doing other things other than climbing. But I do set aside probably 2 or 3 months a year to just go primarily with my family and then just be in the mountains and unplug from everything and just climb. And so that's kind of my food. And also I climb on a daily basis. I mean, I'm sitting in this studio right now covered in chalk, actually, because I was trying to fit in a little climbing session on the way here to do this interview. Like, I need it for my food.
Tommy, it's great to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on Conversations.
Great. Thank you.
Been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.